This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 408, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you. Welcome to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 408. My name is Paul Montgomery. Joining me this week, Mr. Connor Kilpatrick.
Hello.
And our special guest host, Ali Coluccio.
Well, howdy.
She follows the script. I like it.
We are iFanboy, and we like comics, and every week we read a bunch of comics, and one of us picks the best book that they read. We call that the Pick of the Week, and we talk about it on this year podcast, along with, you know, other books and things and stuff and nonsense and goofy things. But before we get to the show, word of caution, this is a review show. We will be talking about all the stuff that happens in those books. So if you're worried about that, if you're worried about spoilers, just pause, come back and join us, and don't call the cops on us.
Spoiler cops!
I told you there might be trouble with my cat. She held up a bank earlier.
Cat was expensive.
God, it's spoiler brigade. This week, Connor had the pick. Connor, what was the pick this week? What did you like? What tickled your fancy?
Funny story. I was sitting on my couch having just finished this week's books, and I was like, oh, crap. Because nothing was really very good. And then I looked on my coffee table and realized, oh, I had missed Zero Number 2. And I read Zero Number 2, and I went, ah, yes. Zero Number 2 from Image Comics and written by Alice Cott. This issue is drawn by Trad Moore. I think each issue, Paul, is having a different artist?
Yeah, it's a different artist for each issue.
This was a great issue. We quite enjoyed issue 1. We talked about it last time it was on the show. But in a week, and I don't mean that to damn Zero with faint praise, but it was a great book. It would have been picked any other week. But this was a week where not much really gave it a run for its money. But Zero 2 really gave us a look at this main character, Edward Zero, who we met in the first issue. Is a secret, enhanced secret agent. He was running around trying to retrieve some technology in the hands of terrorists in the first issue. But we really met him in a flash forward in which he is an old man about to be murdered by a young kid. And in this issue, we really sort of learn his history and why that opening scene in the series is so chilling, because he comes from a agency in which they train you to be a killer and a spy from a very, very, very early age. And it was great. I mean, this was a great character piece and a great sort of delving into his history. And I like the fact that we started the series off him as an adult, and we go back and we learn why things are important later, as opposed to, you know, having the story go chronologically, which probably wouldn't have been as impressive. But
I don't know about you. I'd much rather go to like Hogwarts than the school. this is interesting, because and I like that you said that you know, the first issue, we got to see sort of a field operation, and we got to see also sort of maybe the end of his life and sort of the cruel cycle of these operatives and being trained from a very young age. And now in this issue, we get to see what that training was like and what kind of program that is. And it all culminates in this really intense scene where he has to hide in a house for 3 days and then eliminate this target who is a family man. And he's sitting in this pantry that apparently no one uses for 3 days, and he's just is peering through the crack.
Creepy.
And just watching this guy go about his life. And there's some interesting slice of life stuff where I love this just big rotund dude, this target, this big beardy guy, and Tradmore draws him as like this big barrel chested kind of dude. And I love that panel where he's sitting on the floor between his two kids' beds,
yep,
and like reading them a story. And it's just a very, it's just a casual look at his home life. And, but this is, you know, a dude that's about to be eliminated. And ultimately, Zero does shoot the guy, but it kind of goes square and it goes to the second floor, and he does shoot him like in the arm a couple times. But ultimately, there's a backup agent outside who has to do the final headshot and kill.
Because the kids tend to normally fail on their first mission. It was, I really enjoyed the setup to this. I mean, I liked seeing, you know, the kids who in this creepy school and all that. But I thought really the strength of it was this final scene that you mentioned, which was very intense. And it started off as sort of creepy as he hung out in the house. And he was often a shadow lingering in the background as he watched over things. And then once the violence unfolds, I thought it was a lot of great touches. Like when he goes to shoot his target and he misses, the target goes for his gun and finds that all of his clips are empty. Because clearly he had gone to the house and taken out all the possible weapons this guy could have had. I thought that was a neat twist. And then the fact that he couldn't actually pull the trigger because he is a little kid. But then at the very end, we see sort of his humanity has been stripped away as... At least that's how I interpreted the final three panels, in which he's sitting on the bench talking to his handler, and suddenly it looks like a child has scribbled out their heads with crayon, as it seemed to me to indicate that he was looking as not as people anymore, as then lost their humanity.
I think it's kind of open to interpretation, but it's like, you know, the ambiguity of these two people just too. It could also mean that like these are just two random people sitting on a bench, and they could be anybody. Mm-hmm. And it's just like just how deep undercover they are, how embedded this whole thing is, and I thought a really striking way to end out the issue. Alescott, you're not quite as ubiquitous as Charles Soule, who we'll talk about again in this episode, but his name is getting out there.
Right.
He was on Suicide Squad over at DC. That didn't last too long,
briefly.
But now he's over at Marvel, going to be doing Iron Patriot and Secret Avengers, and some really, really interesting indie stuff. So I would recommend that people check out things like Zero and Wild Children and Change, and just a super intelligent guy with some great insights and really politically charged stories, mm-hmm. not easy stories, not a lot of difficult topics. So
yeah, this is a very gray issue. Allie, did you get a chance to read this?
Yeah, no, I did. It's kind of funny that you said that you liked how it started out with like the future and like being on the mission, and then it went back. Mm-hmm. And I do like that structure, except I read issues 1 and 2 tonight because there were only two, and I figured I might as well read them back to back. And I finished the first one. I was like, I don't know if I'm gonna like this. It was just a bit too. I mean, you have this hard, grizzled character, and there's not really anything to grab onto.
Right.
It's pretty bleak.
In
it's
that
pretty
first issue,
nihilistic.
It's really bleak. I mean, this is also really bleak, but I think you see all those little touchstones and all those little terrible training things that he goes through. And I love there's that scene in the classroom, and they're basically taught that being is being in a state of war, and that's all there is to existence. And then while he's watching this family be a family, while he's creeping in the closet, he hears the mom say that, you know, love is all that there is, and family.
It does not compute in his psychopathic brain.
It does not compute and doesn't really have much of an effect.
No.
I also was very surprised that they were British.
Yeah, if that was we couldn't figure that out in the first issue we talked about on the show. They kept calling the agency, so we figured it was the CIA, but we learned in this issue that they're, it's actually it's a British agency. I can't imagine it's MI6, but...
But in this issue, there's some touching stuff. There's, you know, with the female classmate and...
But I feel like that serves to grind the hope out of us. Like, we see, oh, well, maybe he's got it. Nope, he's awful. But it isn't like evil. He's just been turned into, like, a machine.
For the character, it's definitely, like, grinding down your hope for him. But in terms of the overall world, I think there's some kind of heart under there somewhere with this girl who, and it's you know, it's kind of cold, but like she says, you know, will you marry me? And he says no, and then like she says, but I, you know, we're gonna die, but let's die holding each other's hands. And that's this book's version of hopeful and kind of tender. So I don't know. I like this idea of a different artist each book.
That can very often lead to a jumpy feeling in that, but I like this.
It can, but if it's consistently different each issue, and he seems to be changing up the tone each issue. I don't know necessarily that he's trying to match it up with the artist specifically. But what
I like is that, because is Jordi Belair the colorist throughout?
Yeah, I've never heard of her before. is she up and coming?
She's new to this, I think. I don't know.
She's new. I don't know. Oh, I think she colored every single book I read this week. And she's fantastic and wonderful. But I feel like that keeps, even though the art styles are different, I think that kind of keeps a consistency to the book.
Right.
Like she has a very strong color style.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if that stays consistent and obviously it's the writing stays consistent, I think.
It's one of those fine line things because, you know, it's not that like all of her books look the same, but I can usually tell that it's, you know, that it's a Jordi Belair book, if that makes sense.
Oh,
like
yeah.
But it's also, I don't know. It's, it's a pretty good gamble to say that Jordi Belair colored the book because she's doing everything these days. So
I think the interesting thing about this book is going to be going forward, because I think, Al, your point is very astute in that this could get very oppressively bleak very quickly. The question is, where does it go from here? Now we met him in the field. Now we know why he is what he is. Now what happens? You know, and that's the question for me as a reader. You know, I don't want to read this indefinitely forever. I definitely want to see some sort of character arc going here, but you know.
And I feel like maybe there's got to be something, because like he is, like that opening scene is the kid with the gun to the back of his head, and he's like, "Listen, kid, I have to tell you a story first."
Right. Maybe he does find his humanity, and as he gets older, and that will be the story. But it'll be interesting. I do want to see it where it goes.
I think it's important that he's not that other kid. There's Edward and then Robert.
Right.
Like, who just looks like, I don't know, like Voldemort sitting there. Like, sorry to keep going to the Harry Potter references, but like he looks just like stone cold. And I think it's important that there's a difference, and it's important that he wasn't able to do that kill shot in this issue.
Yeah, Robert definitely killed the person in his first mission. He didn't fail.
Yeah.
But I'm
plenty
glad
of collateral damage too.
I'm glad I read Zero. I wasn't originally going to read it. I just did as a whim the first time, and I'm really enjoying these two. And Alice Cott is someone definitely to keep your eye out for.
It's a really interesting voice, yeah.
So now the only other book that really gave this one a run for its money pick-wise was Hawkeye 13. The only problem I had with it, and this wasn't really a fault of the issue, was just that I couldn't remember when the last time I'd read an issue was, and I couldn't remember where we were in the story. And the way this story was constructed, it sort of weaved in and out of a few issues that we've already read. So that was like triply confusing, because I thought, wait, Kate's back. No, wait, the dog's back. No, wait, now they're gone. And it was...
Yeah, we're seeing Clint's half of some scenes that we had previously seen through the eyes of Lucky the dog and through Kate.
Yeah.
I think in her issues.
I mean, that's not the fault of the issue. It's great. It was another great issue, and I'm sure if you read them all together, it'd be wonderful. It's just for me,
right?
I found a lot of it trying to figure out where I was, which takes you out of the story, because now I'm trying to figure out can I dig up those old issues and figure this out. But
right, but apparently the next issue is coming very quickly, according to the letter in the back. But it's always refreshing to see this book, because like it's a superhero book that looks like a great, European comic that you unearthed at like a flea market or something. Like, right. It looks like this came from like your aunt's trip to Belgium or something. It's just, it's a beautiful looking book, and they can take their time with it. It's, you know,
I'd rather have more them do the book. I'd rather not have the fill-ins, but I'm just, you know, it was a while. And I think if it had been a regular issue, not an issue that blended in with other issues specifically, then it would have been less of a problem. But God, Clint is frustrating. He just, every turn he makes the wrong decision. And I know that's part of the appeal of the book, but you're just like, God, Clint.
Right.
Don't fall asleep while Kate's opening her heart to you.
I that was one of my favorites, was like the reaction shot from the women in his life, just like staring at him like, what is wrong with you? You dirtbag.
Yeah. I mean, I still really love it. It's just there was that problem with it. It's a gorgeous looking book. I love that Clint looks like a person in the world. Like, he wears realistic.
I love that.
He wears clothes.
Yeah, I love that
realistic.
He's always.
And he's always beat up, yeah.
He's always beat up and bandaged, and I think it's fantastic. I can never say enough good things about Hawkeye. Did anybody else notice that this was all 9-panel grids all the way throughout?
I'm noticing it now that you say it.
Now that I mentioned it. I was like halfway through and I was like, hey, this looks familiar.
It really leads to a very dense feeling story when you've got 9-panel grids on every page.
It does, yeah.
You're getting your money's worth.
It does. And it's funny because I liked, there were points where I was like, okay, wait, where are they? But I liked that it's, even though it took so long to get here, it's kind of tied up everything that was all over the place the last few months. So it felt like a really good catch-up issue.
And where else are you in a superhero book you're going to get eye on the toilet? Just straight up on the toilet. No pretenses.
Sometimes you got to poo.
Nowhere but Hawkeye. It really was great to be back.
I like that his brother is here because he's like just as hapless and useless as Clint at times.
Well, it actually makes Clint look like he's got his stuff together, which is pretty shocking. The genes in that family are... They got problems.
Circus people.
Happy it's back, and happy it'll get another issue soon. And I just wish it had been a different issue where they had taken the delay on it, because then I would have been less confused. Now, Indestructible Hulk Special Number 1 is the second part of the story that started in All New X-Men Special Number 1, which was the pick of the week a few weeks ago.
That's right.
I enjoyed it. Another good issue. I thought in the same vein.
It's just super charming.
There's a whole splash page of the Hulk with puppies.
Yeah. They found a way to calm Hulk down and turn him into Banner, dump a bunch of puppies on him.
And it's a bunch of puppies. And then you find out that they're like puppies from people in S.H.I.E.L.D. Which I think is terrifying.
I just want to see that email, this internal memo. Like, anybody puppies. Who's got puppies?
Anybody got not, puppies? Like,
and then, like, the, you know, are there any replies? You're like, well, my dog is like 7 months old. Is that sort of past the cutoff? I'm like, well, what breed dog is it? You know, like, send some pictures, send some JPEGs, and we'll decide if they're cute enough.
Or the guy doesn't respond.
He's a puppy for nothing. Don't worry about it. Not at all to put in front of the Hulk.
Agent Montgomery, we know you have puppies. I think this is fun. I think it's interesting that this story is happening without much fanfare or much... you know, prior, you know, knowledge, by way of putting it, but there hasn't been, I didn't really know it was happening to Paul until you made the pick, and now it's running through.
Yeah, it was just something I was, like, going across Comixology. I was like, what the hell is this? And I was like, it's a special, but it's during an event that they're doing in that same book, like a big crossover thing. And so maybe that's part of it, is that, you know, Infinity's going on right now and Battle of the Atom's going on, so... you know, this isn't being talked about as much, but it's just kind of cool that they're doing... and it's like special. Sometimes they've done them with annuals, mm-hmm. where it's a story that goes across a bunch of them. But it's cool. It's you know, and it's got old school Elton John looking Dr. Octopus, which I always like. And I love the idea that Superior Spider-Man, so Octavius inside Spider-Man's body, is kind of like offended by the return of his old self. Like, he finds himself sort of revolting, and, you know, he's the superior Spider-Man. He's all ego. And, you know, this is an affront to everything that he's accomplished in the past, you know, year or two, whatever, how long this has been. And
it continues to be super charming with young Hank McCoy, who's a big fan of Rod Stewart. That's his idea of contemporary music.
Well, now we know they're from the 80s. That's
yeah, our answer. Exactly. I was thinking that. Yeah, it kind of puts a date stamp on the whole thing. But I love these characters. I'm so glad that it appears that they're, you know, around for at least a while, these young X-Men in the modern day. I think it was such a weird idea, but then they bring this interesting perspective to everything that's happened since then, which is, it's kind of a meta commentary, but not in an obnoxious way.
It's worked so, so well. I really thought it was going to be terrible. It's probably one of my like most happy surprises of the whole Marvel Now thing, is that original flavor X-Men are back, and they just fit really well with everything.
Mm-hmm. I like that this issue was very science oriented. You know, like it was, you had Bruce Banner and you had Secret Dr. Octopus and you had Hank McCoy and you had these other scientists in a room trying to figure this problem out of, are these time travelers? Are they LMDs? What's going on? Why are there these? And I liked that aspect of it, where when, while that was happening, the rest of the X-Men were bored. Because
yeah, oh, that like the two-page thing where you travel around the page and it tells this like story of like several hours of just sitting around the lab. That was wonderful.
Yeah, no, I liked it a lot. It's been so a really good. Fun story. Mike Costas has written both issues and he's done a great job. It's been really, really fun.
I did not even know this was a thing at all.
No, I mean, it was crazy. I'm glad, Paul, you picked it, because otherwise I would have missed it. And so there you go.
I'm glad I picked it too.
One of the best things about having guests on the show, like Allie, is that you'll often want to talk about books we don't normally talk about, like The Sixth Gun. So number 35 came out this week. Allie, why don't you tell us how that's been going, how the book's been lately? Because Paul and I both read this in trade.
Yeah, I felt like there was a point where I was going to go back to trade reading, but I'm terrible at actually buying trades. So I've stuck with it in issues, and I'm so happy it's already at issue 35.
It's crazy. I'm really happy it's lasted so long. Yeah.
And, you know, and they're going on to their next arc. And so the last arc has been Becky in the spirit world, basically. Bad stuff happens with the guns. And she gets put in this, like, I think they call it a ghost walk, a ghost trance. And so it's like this guided spiritual thing. And they're hiding with a bunch of Native Americans while the Widow Hume is beating down on them with her crazy frog-like mother-in-law. Who's a witch, obviously.
Is she getting high? Is that what this is?
I don't, it could be.
Peyote?
Peyote.
But there's always the staple of when you go on one of these spiritual journeys, you're met by a spirit animal, and that spirit animal walks you through your path. Mm-hmm. Except that Becky's spirit animal gets shot by an outside force that's trying to kill her regular body in like the first issue she goes under. And so basically she's traveling alone, running from all of these outside forces that are literally outside the hut that she is in and in the spirit world. And basically she's got to find her way through all of the different parallel futures that the guns would create. So the thing about the six guns is there are six of them and they all have crazy, wacky, mystical powers. And when you bring them all together, you can destroy the world and rebuild it however you want to rebuild it. So depending on who has the guns, when shit goes down, they build the world however they see fit. So Becky is basically running through all of these different worlds. And
that's cool.
It's really cool. And so this issue, well, this last page from the last issue, and in this issue, it's her on the farm with her dad, and she's married to the blonde guy whose name I never remember, and they have two kids. And so it was the world that she created, having the guns. And so she has a very nasty confrontation with herself, and then luckily finally gets out and wakes up.
It's a great series. I'm really glad it's continuing. One of my favorite things about it that no one ever talks about, or just so it's my little quirk, is that it's full of great names.
Yeah.
Colin Bunn comes with great names for the characters. Just like, you know, somewhat minor thing, but I always enjoy whenever a new character shows up with a great name.
Yeah,
great
book. The Widow Hume's mother-in-law's name is Griselda.
Exactly.
Which is pretty fantastic.
So now I'm really curious, Allie, to see what you're thinking of Wonder Woman these days. Wonder Woman 24, this is the aftermath of the basically the 23-issue arc we had to open this book up, in which Wonder Woman made her journey to end up as the god of war in the Olympian pantheon. And so this issue we had a Goran Tsuzuka fill in, who I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, I've been liking his fill-ins. I liked Tony Atkins, too, when he was coming in on stuff. I mean, it's not Cliff Chang, but it's still damn good. No. And the Matt colors are...
So what do we think, Allie? You're a real big Wonder Woman fan.
I'm along for the ride with Azzarello and with this. I bought in very early, and I felt like it was kind of meandering for a bit.
There was definitely a bit in the middle where it was.
Yeah, and so I feel like the last, like, 5-6 issues, it's gotten back to where...
Yeah.
All right, this is a book I need to read every time it comes out. And then they had Villains Month. But
exactly.
And every story's ground to a halt. One thing I think that's really important about this, people were complaining when she was originally made God of War because it's a sort of antithesis of peace, but she doesn't want to be God of War. And that's where the drama comes from. It's not like she's reveling in being God of War. She's been given this position that she does not want. And that's the drama.
A lot of issue too. Yeah. Like, I didn't really have a choice. Like, she did what had to be done, and she's going to deal with the consequences in the way that she has to. But no, she doesn't. She doesn't want to be part of Olympus. She doesn't want to be an Olympian. She definitely doesn't want to be the god of war. But I think it's also, I feel like Wonder Woman and the Amazons in general probably have a complicated relationship with the god of war, because they are a warrior race.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, you know, they are these elite warriors, these warriors that are better than most of the men. And while they, for the most part, have lived in peace on Themyscira to kind of stay away from everything, they still train as warriors. So I feel like that's always a little bit in the background of the character.
Right.
Yeah, and when she had to kill War, that was one of my picks of the week. And what I loved about that was that, and it wasn't a new thing for that issue, but I love that War isn't a bad guy. I mean, he's a very complex character with interesting motivations. But that original War was such an, and that not even decision, that need to kill him was such an interesting story choice and created this really... interesting dynamic where she's part of this chess game that Apollo is playing, and he's trying to form these alliances with the other gods, and ridiculous looking Poseidon and just with his walrus head and his tentacles and stuff. And I thought Strife was really interesting in this issue, because you'd think like Strife and War would be like this, but they had a very tempestuous relationship, which kind of makes sense being that her name was Strife. But I like that she's kind of like drunk in mourning and coming in and like, you guys didn't, he just died and there's no respect at all. And now it looks like she's going to go after Diana to herself become the new god of war. So I think that's going to be, because
Diana will be happy to hand it off.
I think so too.
It didn't mean her dying. She'd be fine with giving her that title.
You know,
but
what did you think of the coat?
But she'd be okay giving that title to Strife, though.
Right.
I think she does not want to be the god of war. She doesn't. But she also doesn't want other people being the god of war either. And I think that'll be something interesting to see play out.
Right.
Because the whole reason that she kills War and takes on his mantle is because she doesn't want the firstborn to... She doesn't want that to fall on the firstborn, and I don't think she'd want it to fall onto Strife either.
Allie, if it meant destroying that car outside, you could be the god of war.
I was going to say, there was a car alarm. I moved to Jersey, and apparently.
I think that one of the best things about this book is that it's very complex and interesting, which seems so trite, but it's true. There's a very interesting story happening here, and there's a lot of complicated dealings between the characters and relationships, and...
Kind of a Game of Thrones kind of political intrigue kind of thing, and a little infighting, and that's always fun.
I really like
that. It's brilliant. I love the I love that we got to see Hermes again for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, and he was just trying to protect the scion of Zeus,
which was cool. And again, completely complicated and throwing wrenches and gears left and right. I really like what Azzarello is doing with this book, and I can't be happier that the Wonder Woman book is so complex and rich and fantastic.
It's a great book. It's one of DC's best by far.
I want to talk about Letter 44, number one, because we haven't talked about Charles Soule this week yet. This is a new Oni series by Charles Soule and Alberto Albuquerque. Letter 44, being talked about a lot from a lot of creators on Twitter, so I better check this out. And it's interesting because, you know, he's been doing so many mainstream books. Let's see him do his own sort of creator-owned kind of series.
He started with those.
Oh, yeah, I know. But let's see what it's like now after, you know, having done, you know, Swamp Thing and Thunderbolts and all these books. He's doing, and, you know, Superman Wonder Woman, which you guys talked about last week. Letter 44 is the referring to the letter left for incoming President 44 of the United States, who seems to be an Hispanic analog for Barack Obama. And
oh, I heard about this book. I should have got this.
Letter. Okay, and then President 43, President Carroll, is clearly an analog for George W. Bush, and basically this new president, President Blades, comes in, and he picks up this letter. This is a thing that, you know, in real life, you know, the president leaves a note for the incoming president on his last day. And so he opens up this letter marked 44. This is before he's sworn in. And it basically says that all this stuff that I've been doing, that you think I'm a moron, I'm this hick, and I'm, you know, this warmonger and stuff, all these choices have just, you know, driven the country into the ground with all these wars that we don't belong in and stuff. But all those choices were because there is some alien stuff going on up there in outer space, and they're building like a gun up there, and we don't know what's going on. But so all of these choices, it's like the reason I'm, you know, building up our military complex is so we'll be prepared for whatever they want to do. And, you know, and all of these choices, like he says, you know, he's let the economy sort of go to pot because it doesn't matter compared to this alien threat. And basically this is President Blades has to deal with this. Now, the other component is that they sent a spaceship up there called the Clark, and it's full of all these scientists, one of which is now pregnant. Mm-hmm. And they're heading towards this construction site in outer space that they found to rendezvous with it to see what's going on. Nobody knows about it but the president. And my only real problem with this book is that the president believes the letter right off the bat. Like, he doesn't. There isn't a second where he's like, this is a practical joke from the outgoing president. Like, that's weird. This is usually, you know, kind of a sacred ritual. You decided to pull a prank, but, you know, we're from opposite ends of the political spectrum. You're having fun with me. This is like, you know, Donna in the West Wing on her first day and the iodine tablets and the missiles under the Eisenhower putting green, that whole thing.
Yeah.
He doesn't suspect for a second that it's a joke.
Guys,
and he goes around
an alien problem.
And he goes around asking people, and they're like, "Well, it's like, we try to keep that secret around here." But I just thought it was a little odd that there isn't like a panel or two devoted to, well, this is clearly a joke. This is clearly.
Because if I had known, I would not have run.
And I just mean, like, after I just watched like House of Cards, and so like maybe I have like the more cynical view of, like, you know, what these relationships are like. And they spend a lot of the issue talking about, like, him and his chief of staff talking about how this guy is a moron and they hate each other and they don't agree with any of his decisions. And so why would you automatically believe something as outlandish as there's aliens up there? That's why I did all these things.
It's a weird, I'm actually reading a book right now called The President's Club. It's about ex-presidents and their relationship with their current presidents. And it's a very interesting dynamic they have. A lot of them become friends and allies after hating each other.
Nonfiction, you mean?
Yes, nonfiction. It's real.
Yeah.
yes, it's real life, Paul. I heard about this book a few months ago, and I knew I wanted to read it, and I missed it.
It's a very interesting book. I like the art. It was just that one suspension of disbelief kind of thing that kind of bothered me. But I'm curious to see where it goes. Cool. Very similar, I guess, to Paul Cornell's book Saucer Country.
Right.
I like this a little bit better.
Tell people quickly how they can help the show.
You can pick out things like Saucer Country and the Snoopy Snow Cone Machine, I guess.
Do they have that on Amazon?
Do they have
I'm
it?
Sure they
buy
do.
That.
I'm sure they do. iFanboy.com/Amazon. And, you know, Amazon gets all the monies. they've got deep pockets, so why not let some of that slip through their deep pockets into our smaller pockets?
Much smaller, lint-filled pockets.
Help us keep the lights on. We would greatly appreciate that. You can also go to the site, and we have a thing in the toolbar for memberships. So you can give us a little bit of support if you'd like each month. It's less than it used to be.
$3 and $30.
A bargain. Yes. So you can help us out and help keep the lights on over at iFanboy.
Thank you.
Keep producing great content for you.
And we appreciate everyone who donates or becomes a member and or uses iFanboy's Amazon link. This issue of Animal Man 24 featured the art by Raphael Albuquerque. I just don't care about all this stuff in the red and the green and the gray. I don't. And that's the.
Are they still in the red?
They went back.
They're never leaving the red alley ever.
It's lost in the island.
They took a step out of the red for a little bit, and there was like all the great stuff, like the him being nominated, yeah, you know, for an Oscar or whatever.
I also thought they could do a better job in this issue of hiding the fact that they can't say Academy Awards because of licensing reasons. They could have done a better job of just that instead of making up a fake award name, which sounded stupid. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm just calling it the Oscar.
The Globies.
I have this problem with all these books. When Earth 2 was dealing with the gray and Swamp Thing and the green, and I just don't care about any of these things. It's nothing to do with the individual talents of the writers.
Darkest Night stuff with all the colored lantern stuff.
I just don't care. I don't care.
You know what I meant.
I know what you mean.
I feel like, and it's part of the reason I kind of drifted away from Animal Man, is I loved all of the smaller character family moments, and not this giant mythos. And the mythos is cool, and I understand what they're doing with it.
You know, touch on the mythos occasionally.
Come on,
just do it. You know, one every 6 months, then he has to deal with stuff in the red. That's fine, but he could be a superhero otherwise, and not be. You know, I just
it's like they're reading like Magic the Gathering cards. Like they're just it's all the world building stuff is like too much in the foreground. Yeah. Like let some of it be unsaid, and then you get to have like, I mean, there's cool images in here. Like there was like a llama thing with a hat.
Raphael Albuquerque did a great job with it.
Pirate. Yeah, it's gorgeous looking monsters and stuff, and like weird like body horror kind of things. And I like that, but stop like giving things names and talking about it. And it's all this abstract stuff that they're trying to make concrete. And it's just like this walking nightmare. And I'm with you guys. I prefer the domestic stuff and dealing with the family and dealing with the, you know, him being nominated for this award when his kid just died.
Well,
like,
they're not going to deal with that anymore because apparently in the DCU there'll be no more movies, seeing as how the red attacks the Oscars and kills everyone.
Exactly.
So no more movies, DCU, because Tom Hanks is dead.
Oh man! See, even in the DCU, a Wonder Woman movie can't get made.
Paul, what is Strange Nation?
Strange Nation is a new book by Paul Allor and artist Juan Romero. And here's the thing: so I'm talking about a bunch of alien stuff this week. This is not really my territory. Like, I'm not really an X-Files guy, but I know Paul Allor. He writes some great stuff. I'll put him up there in the LS Pot camp in terms of guys you should be watching. He's done some Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles micro series stuff. He's going to do the Shredder book, and let's see what Paul Allor is up to. And he has this great voice where it's fun reading his books. Some writers you want to be like transparent and you don't want to pay attention to the prose, but his dialogue and his caption boxes are so just well written that he's a great prose stylist, but doesn't get in the way of the read. And so anyways, this is a sort of a gray alien kind of story, an X-Files kind of story about this woman who was a legit journalist who happened to stumble onto a situation where she was tracking cultists in the woods who were getting into fist fights with Sasquatches while a flying saucer was overhead. And she's taking pictures of the stuff because she's a reporter. She's a journalist. And she takes this back to her editor. And he's like, you're a crazy person. This is for tabloids. And basically she was laughed out of journalism.
She should have taken it to the president. And he would have been like,
she should have taken it to the president.
She should have written a letter.
Bomb the Borsts.
And so now she's like, what am I going to do? So she signs up to write for this Strange Nation thing. And her doting parents, who seem to be very wealthy, are very interested in, you know, her prospects. And they hold these parties where it's clear that they're trying to wine and dine these people into hiring her, maybe for like a PR job or something. But she knows the truth. The truth is out there. She has seen this stuff. And there's also this inkling at the end of the issue that her father might be involved, because in his closet, he's got a cultist's robe, similar to the ones worn by the guys doing this ritual in the forest in the beginning.
All rich people are part of cults or secret societies.
Exactly. This has got a gorilla who's become sentient, basically. It's like a gorilla head grafted onto a regular dude's body. Mm. And, you know, government conspiracy secret kind of stuff. And I thought it was really entertaining. I thought it was funny that all the characters have really rich sort of backstories, which is really impressive for like a single issue. Like, it just felt like these characters had history. They had lived. This is a lived in world. And I will be reading more of this. I'm excited about it. This is from Monkey Brain.
Oh, okay.
Oh, nice.
Cool. Let's take a quick detour into the event side of the comic book world. Quickly, what's going on with Infinity?
Okay, I'm the Infinity guy. Avengers number 21, and this is Hickman and Lanil Francis Yu, and it's you, so it looks fantastic. I love the way Yu draws operatic space stuff. Same with Jerome Pena. I think these two guys in particular have been perfect for this story. The reason I wanted to talk about Avengers 21, if you're into Marvel Cosmic, which I love Guardians of the Galaxy, not particularly this volume of it, but like the Abnett and Lanning stuff, because it went into the lore. This book we've talked about a lot, because Infinity, because Hickman sort of pulled out, you know, like he's pulled back on the lens so that it's more about the macrocosm, like the bigger picture of the Marvel universe. And it's a little bit arm's length with the characters. So what he does do really well is the mythology. And there's some really interesting things that happened in this issue. Like, previously, the supreme intelligence of the Kree, the big floaty giant head thing, said that, you know, we're going to bow down to these bad dudes and we're not going to fight because so much bad has happened and we don't want anyone to die. And Ronan the Accuser, who's like this born warrior, was forced to lay down arms and say, okay, I'm going to surrender. Not so much this issue. He decides to hammer into the head of the supreme intelligence and say, no, I'm fighting with the Avengers. I'm fighting the good fight. I don't want to lay down arms. And also, they unleashed their trump card, the Annihilation Wave, against these bad guys, against the architects or the builders. And the builders are like, those things are based on a hive mind. So what if we have them just eat each other? What if we just use telepathy to say, you bite that one, and then that one bites that one, and that one bites the other one, and they keep just killing each other? So they destroy the Annihilation Wave, which is one of the nastiest things in the Marvel Universe.
How far into this event are we now? Halfway?
We're near the end. I think there's this, you know, we're coming up on issue 6 of Infinity, 5 or 6, and there's a couple of new Avengers and Avengers issues around there, but It's looking dire for the Avengers and everybody.
Well, meanwhile, I have no idea what to make of Forever Evil. This Justice League of America number 8 was the tie-in this week, and I don't know how to follow the story. There's no tie. There's no through line. It's just random issues. Some of them are tied in, some of them are not. They're tied in different ways. We had the Villains Month, which was tied in, but it wasn't necessarily, depending on the comic. And
so is this the end of it, or?
I don't even know, but this issue, one of the big things that's been going on is the Justice League is dead. We killed the Justice League. Well, here they are. They're in this issue, if you were looking for them. If you had missed the Justice League here, they were found here. I don't know how you would know that if you weren't, you know, like reading every single thing with Forever Evil on it, but this seems to be a fairly pivotal issue, but here it is. And as Martian Manhunter and Stargirl find a prison underground that has all of the Justice League members in it as they are being ripped apart psychologically, so everybody's greatest fears are being amplified in these different prison levels they're in, and it was a fine issue, but it's just like, I don't know, I have no through line, I have no way to hold on to the story when it just seems completely random.
Yeah, because I mean, that's what we were saying with the Villains Month stuff, was that like there's no connective tissue aside from the fact
there's
that the
no
Justice League is dead
whatever, at all.
But like, yeah, it's just it's very like episodic, sort of just showcases. But then some of them have the Justice League thing in the background, and like, was it Ultraman?
Yep.
Moving the moon.
Right.
Like that stuff's in the background, but it seems just sort of ancillary to just doing a showcase for the villains. Whereas like Azzarello just used it to, you know, talk about his firstborn villain.
Right. And there's nothing to hold on to for me in terms of a story. There's no story that's being told as far as I can tell. I mean, maybe I'm reading the wrong ones, but I should know. There should be a mini that's got the story in it. I need to know what I'm reading here. And I don't. But this was good. Doug Monkey drew it. So anyway, those are the books of the week we're going to talk about. You can't go to fanboy.com/comics. I just went into autopilot there. The reason why I went into autopilot is because
you just broke everybody's heart. They got so excited for 2 seconds.
It's back.
We can go back.
Well, let me tell you what happened here. We're going to talk about the book of the month. We're still going to do the book of the month discussions. And this we're talking about October's book of the month. And here's the mistake I made. We started recording the show. I'm in California. The sun was up. The sun is now down, but I did not turn on any lights in anticipation of the sun being down. So I can't actually see what I'm holding in my hands.
You don't remember what the book of the month is.
I have the book of the month in my hand, but I can't really. It's all I have is the light of this tiny laptop monitor.
Okay, well, I'll tell you. It's Jack Kirby's OMAC, One Man Army Corps.
Correct. This was the collection that DC put out last month, collecting Jack Kirby's original OMAC story. Now, funny story about, and we, Paul and I are big fans of the New 52 OMAC book. That,
yes.
That's the Mohawk guy, right?
Yes, correct. Yes. Giffen and Dan DiDio and Scott Kolbisch did that book. And it went eight issues and it was canceled. So did Jack Kirby's original OMAC story. It only went eight issues, which is a strange either coincidence or by design kind of thing. But after Kirby left Marvel and all of the rigmarole about the going back and the rights to his characters and his original art and all that stuff, he went over to DC to do a bunch of work and created the New Gods and he created Darkseid and all those things. And then he also did a book called OMAC, which was, it's so very much of its time. It's I believe, and I can't read anything in here. I believe it's the 70s, and it's basically One Man Army Corps. It's similar to the new one in that there's this guy and he's turned into, by Brother Eye turns him into this one man wrecking crew who goes around fighting bad guys. Some of them is about human trafficking. Some of it's about warfare. I mean, he just runs around fighting evil basically, while working for a very UN type organization of guys wearing creepy red masks because, as every issue tells you, they are of every nation and therefore you cannot see their face because they have to represent everyone. So they delight in reminding that OMAC of that in every issue, but it's sort of a fascinating look into, and I want to say Kirby's madness because he's not crazy. It's just it's very much him looking at society and writing and drawing about it. There's a really creepy issue in which rich old people kidnap young people and have their brains transplanted into their bodies, and it's weird. Like, it's like an auction. You know, they have an auction of these kidnapped young people, and they're like, oh, I want that one. I want the blonde one. And then they get brain transferred in, and it's just weird. I think he's looking at the world and just seeing a cultural revolution, and you know, he's a guy from the 40s. He fought World War II, and it's all a little freaky. And it's not like the young people are bad. It's just the world is changing, so he's trying to interpret that in his work, and it's just a lot of strange things going on, and just really dynamic, crazy Kirby art. And the thing that's interesting about it is he left the book rather abruptly. And so in order to make that make sense, they had somebody come in and draw a final panel that wrapped the whole series up very quickly.
Just in the final panel.
Yes. It's not even, it's a sound effect and then two caption boxes saying, yep, the book's over and everything was okay in the end. And it's just very, very weird. It was very trippy. I felt like...
Is it like less number of pages than usual, that issue? Or
no, they literally... It wasn't supposed to be the last issue, but since it was, they had somebody just come in and draw a panel saying, but below, the effort has caused an overload in Dr. Scuba's equipment. The island explodes in a giant fireball, and his very success brings destruction to the evil Scuba. Is this the end?
And it was the end.
Maybe, I don't know, OMAC's just like a... It's like a nova. Like, he glows so brightly,
he burns brightly
for just an instant and then burns out just as quickly.
It's very dense. It's sort of like we were talking about the nine panel grids earlier, and This is 8 issues, and it took me probably the better part of a week to read, because this is, you know, old school comics, so they just cram in the panels, they cram in the word balloons, they cram in the caption boxes, and...
So the caption's basically explaining everything that's happening that you can see visually.
Which I love. I love that stuff, and I love old comics.
Yeah, and like that's it's charming. Like most of my experience with Kirby is from like the Fourth World stuff, like the Newsboy Legion, and with Commandy. Right. I haven't read OMAC, but with Commandy, it can be a little bit discouraging. I was like, yeah, obviously that's what's going on. I can see it. Like the visual storytelling is so good, you don't need that stuff in there. But then also, it's just like it's so quaint and of its time that you kind of love it. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit cozy. So OMAC is a character. Is it just like, is it all missions, or does he have a personal life?
He's got business to take care of, and he takes care of the business. You know, we only really learn of him in the beginning when he becomes OMAC, and then from there it's just from one mission to the next. It's really creepy. I just opened a page up to find a woman in a box. She's just a head and hands and two legs, but she's talking. It's very weird. It's a very weird book.
And you said you think it's like it's Kirby kind of solving or coping with societal problems that he sees.
I think there's a lot of things in here about, you know, the 70s was a strange time coming out of the 60s, the social upheaval. And it's not, again, it's not a critique of youth culture at all, but there's certainly things in it, you know, of technology being too rampant, obsession with youth, that kind of thing.
Is it possible he was just really, really high?
It's possible, but it's also possible that his brain just worked in this other level of creativity, mm-hmm. that all kinds of just strange ideas lived in, and he had to get them out. And because, you know, there's more imagination in this page, each page of this book, than you'll find in a lot of comics. Because
it's weird, but like, I, even though, you know, just responsible for Kirby dots and a lot of that cosmic stuff, like, whenever I look at even the weirdest Kirby stuff, it's not, I don't get like psychedelia out of it. I get like, and maybe that's just his age, but I just get wild, unfettered imagination.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. He does great chapter pages in this. He gives them giant titles and a little melodramatic little intro at the top. It's wonderful.
Cool.
Just wonderful. And I was also in this collection put in some of the original pages. You can see where he wrote in the titles and he wrote in the captions and wrote in the dialogue balloons and everything.
That's
wonderful. He did this whole entire thing himself. He wrote, drew, and edited the whole the series.
Of course he did.
Along with 15 other series at the same time.
Exactly.
I think. I'm not sure. But if you're a fan of Kirby's or OMAC, check out Jack Kirby's OMAC One Man Army Corps. And I wish I could give you more details, but I literally cannot see the pages very well. So sorry.
Is it nice? Is it nice paper? That's always a thing.
It's actually not. It's actually, I mean, I think they're realistic about the potential audience for this book. And it's rough pages. I mean, mm-hmm. it looks great because that's, you know, the art wasn't really meant for slick, glossy work. So rough pages, but good stuff. Now let's cram at least one email in here, depending on how long we go. From the audience, let's read R3V's email. He says, I didn't expect much from Avengers Arena, but like many, I was pleasantly surprised. Originally, I think the creator stated that this was going to be an ongoing series, but now I guess it's set to end after issue 18. I suppose that's for the best, since many of us are wondering how they could continue this arena-themed book after the storyline wraps up. This has got me thinking about all new X-Men. Will Bendis at some point send them back to the past? If so, then what happens to the book? Could it be continued on with them in their own time period? What do you think is the future of this book? A thing that Marvel's doing, which they haven't like announced, they haven't said, you know, this is what we're doing, but I think what they're doing is, from what I've been told, and Avengers Arena isn't ending, it's just continuing on with a new title and a new number.
And that's always been part of the plan.
Yeah, it's they're sort of doing volumes of stories. They're not really doing never-ending sagas.
Interesting. Yeah.
So like Avengers Arena, the first volume is them in the arena, and the second volume is them out of the arena escaping, and they start over with their number one, they start the story over again. Sort of like seasons in TV seasons are...
Yeah, I've done some interviews for Marvel.com with Dennis Hopeless about that, and it's always sort of been the plan that Avengers Arena is a finite narrative, yeah. And this is the next thing. Now, they're also saying, you know, it's a new start. Like, so anybody could pick this up even if you hadn't read Avengers Arena, but there's clearly some fallout from Arena in Avengers Undercover.
Right. Which is the next volume.
And also, there's Zemo. There's Baron Zemo. So
it's, yeah, I mean, I think they're doing more. It's like kind of like when Remender took over on X-Force. They made Uncanny X-Force, and they started it over in a Volume 1. I think that's sort of the model they're going for, is these creators have a story to tell. They get their volume, or two volumes, or whatever, and they do that, and they start over again. Now, all new X-Men, there's no reason why the book can't continue on without the original X-Men, and it's not like it's called Original X-Men. You know, it's just called All New X-Men. So,
what would it be about then?
Well, I mean, just that team. You know,
what team?
The other X-Men in the book. There's other X-Men in the book. The book's not, I mean,
I mean, it would be interesting because the other X-Men that are in that book are the X-Men that are in. You know, they're either pulling in from Uncanny, which is Cyclops's new team, or they're pulling in from Wolverine and the X-Men.
Right.
And it is kind of interesting to see what they would do in the second volume of that. But I do think that they kind of have to go back eventually.
You'd think so, although they seem to imply that Jean never does, apparently, according to this storyline. But
I think, I mean...
They have to go back, clearly. Otherwise,
they have to go back.
It's a paradox.
Right.
Well, in the most recent issue of... Which one is it? Is it All New? No, it's Uncanny. I'm sorry. Uncanny X-Men that just came out this week, they tried to send them back and they couldn't.
Right.
And they suggested that maybe it's because they've been here so in the present for so long and seen so much that they're no longer bound by temporal laws or whatever. So like they'd be an anachronism even if they were sent back. So now they're clearly an artifact of this era now. Like they've almost claimed it as their own. They've just like, you know, sunk their claws into it. And so I think they're here to stay for good while.
It was funny that issue when that one guy went back in time very briefly to make sure it was actually working, and he said he saw Professor X in the garden. And do you think he's wondering where the X-Men are? Like, didn't I have a bunch of kids?
Well, that's the wonky thing with, you know, time travel stuff is like they could be here for a while, but then like you send them back like the second after, you know, they disappeared. Or the whole Battle of the Atom thing has shown that it's even more complex than we thought in terms of like adding the future generations mm-hmm. of X-Men, and like they're not even there just mutanitarian reasons to like benign reasons to save the future. It's more selfish,
right?
And that's caused the clash between other future X-Men, including Motorhead Stash Colossus, who's the coolest character ever. has a sword now.
So I think Ali, I think you're right. They could very easily just end the book if that story ended, because it there's nothing that says you can't end a book, but I also think you could just take the title and continue it on with a new.
Yeah, you could. And it could be like the super future team, or there's the new mutants that are hanging out with Cyclops.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things you can do.
School. Like, there are plenty of X-Men that they could fill.
Yeah, it's no lack.
An all new X-Men book with a new team.
As long as none of them are Gambit.
I just live in the now, man. I love that it's happening now, and I try not to think about where it's going to go.
That's true.
R3V or Rev, perhaps. I want to entertain this idea about sending them back to the past, because that could also be interesting, of having characters that go back in time and they know about the future, and we also get to see them, you know, in the past. Maybe have some of the present X-Men stuck in the past as well, like have Wolverine go back because he wasn't around at that point, or at least not with the X-Men.
The cynical side of me says that the audience wouldn't care because it's not now, and they would. So
that's true.
Yeah, trapped in the past. I don't think is a cool.
It's not happening
now. I don't think it would fly. I would read the heck out of it.
I would read the heck out of that. I love that book. I love these characters.
Because I do want to see what happens when they go back, and if Xavier really does just wipe their brains so that it doesn't screw up.
I hate that my flights of fancy have to be tempered by what boring people like.
It's a good
book. I think that would be fun.
Ali and I are both saying we would read the hell out of your book.
Okay.
So what do you want from us?
You know, like,
you
they go to a Stewart concert and
they just be an all
backstage.
It's a bunch of 80s jokes, a bunch of shoulder pads.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it could be fun. Like, I don't know, do some specials or something.
They don't have a hair like they just came from the 80s. Their hair doesn't seem to.
No, that's the other thing that, like, because, and when they first came in, like, Jean's hair looked very Mad Men-y.
Yeah, it was straight out of the 60s, yet they clearly, I mean.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know, maybe the 70s. Because
Hank has some Murder, She Wrote glasses, like those huge glasses.
Yeah, he does.
You think one of them would have feathered hair or something.
Yeah.
Flock of seagulls.
Bobby.
Especially Angel. I feel
Angel
like,
would have Flock of Seagulls like, haircut. Well, somebody would be New Wave.
Yeah.
Come on.
Edward, aka Heroville, says something I've been mulling over. Who would you say are the best female mystery / crime writers in comics? I ask because while I recognize that there is a strata of male writers who are immediately praised for their ability in the subgenre, I realize that I can't think of any women who are, and I'd like to correct this ignorance on my part.
I was thinking about this before, and I think the part of the problem is there's not a lot of crime mystery comics.
I think that's what it is too, because I don't know.
They
really
end up being sort of, and I don't want to say it this way, but like vanity projects, like Brubaker can like clearly loves that stuff and can do them because he's Brubaker.
Or Rucka, but I mean they just don't make a lot of these comics.
But like they don't like that's like they wouldn't just do a mystery like greenlight a mystery series from just anybody. So it ends up being like the superstars doing them through like Icon kind of imprints. Or, you know, like Bendis with Scarlet is, I don't know, that's not really a crime. But,
yeah, that's not really
okay,
a crime.
So,
the only thing I could think of was Jen Van Meter did a Black Cat miniseries a few years ago that had Amanda Connor covers. And it was a fun heist kind of thing.
Yes, those were
but
good.
That's not really mystery or crime.
Yeah, I was trying to think of what's a mystery crime book now. And I mean, Rucka's not even doing one right now. He's doing last
See, I would go to...
Well,
some,
I mean, yeah. Summertown
I love crime fiction. Like, I read a lot of crime novels. And some of my favorite crime writers, like, I think most of my favorite crime writers are women. And so... And a few of them have written comics. So, like, Denise Mina...
Yes. She did one of those Vertigo crime books, didn't she?
She did the Vertigo, one of the like last ones of those Vertigo crime books. She also is writing the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo adaptations for DC or Vertigo or whatever it is. And she's really good. She's a Scottish crime writer. She's fantastic. Megan Abbott, also mostly known as being a novelist and a crime novelist, wrote an issue of Punisher Max. It was after Jason Aaron's run. They did a couple of one shots, and so she did that, and I'm hoping she does some more comic stuff.
Yeah, I think that's. The problem is there's not. It's just a hard to write, to figure out who would be a good male crime writer because there's only really three or four people doing crime comics at all.
And then I would just say like Karina Becko with Gabriel Hardman did that. What the hell is the book? The Swamp book.
The Swamp Thing.
Swamp? No, it's the Swamp Thing. Let me look it up.
So there you go, Edward. Paul's going to look up your answer. And unfortunately, there aren't just not a lot of examples of the genre to choose from. But hopefully there will be more, I hope. In the meantime, while Paul continues to look, you can email us at contact@ifanboy.com or call our voicemail line at...
Heathentown.
888-FANBOYS, 326-2697 to leave us a voicemail. Tell us your name and where you're from. Keep your voicemails around 30 seconds.
It's not crime, but it's pulp.
Now, Paul, quickly plug your crime show.
My crime show.
The Breaking Bad podcast.
The Breaking Bad podcast is called Fuzzy Typewriter, and we just wrapped up doing episode-by-episode breakdowns of Breaking Bad, this final 8 episodes with Rebecca Shinsky of Book Riot and Book Rageous. She's fantastic. She'll be back to talk about some more stuff soon, maybe some Mad Men next year.
Do it.
And what else? And we just and then Dave, my usual Dave Acampo, my usual co-host, was on recently. We talked about Gravity. Coming up, we'll be talking about 12 Angry Men with our buddy Cameron Rice. Sweet. So that's coming up on Fuzzy Typewriter. You can find us at fuzzytypewriter.com.
Cool. Head over to ifanboy.com to comment about this show. You can if we've missed some crime writers, please tell us in the comments. Also follow us at twitter.com/ifanboy, at facebook.com/ifanboy. That's where you can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out. Therefore, if you're ready for the show, you're all set to go on Sunday when it comes out live. Is it live? Can you tell I haven't eaten dinner? Starting to fade and get stupider.
and you're alone in the dark.
And I'm alone in the dark. It's just a very sad life. Not helping the situation. Yeah. California, I was promised much happier things.
I thought it was always sunny, like always.
It is until the Earth tilts away from the sun, and then we can't do anything about it.
Stupid Earth.
Stupid Earth.
You can email the guys at contact@ifanboy.com or leave a voicemail message at 1-888-FANBOYS, 38 no I. And you can ask them questions, comments, concerns, discussion topics, campfire songs, anything on your mind.
Campfire songs, that's a good one.
And if you dig this kind of thing, write us a review on iTunes, or better yet, you can tell your friends about us, introduce your mother to podcasts, word to your mom, spread the iFanboy word.
Well, that's it for the show. Allie, thank you for joining us. You were wonderful. Please come back soon.
Thank you for having me.
You're much nicer and more polite than some of the people we've had on lately, whose name I won't mention, but they're also called Ryan and Mike sometimes. So there you go. That's it for this week's show. I'm Connor.
I'm Paul.
I'm Allie.
Oh.
I'm Allie. Sorry.
Paul jumped on Allie's line. See, Allie, you're the only
person. I'm usually second. I'm sorry. I'm rusty. I was gone.
I was doing so well and following the script.
Goodbye.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also like, one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.